Hello, it's All in the Mind. I'm Lynne Malcolm. Today, a shift in approach to mental health in crisis.
Psychosis happens not only to the person, but the whole family. And everyone needs to make sense of what's happening. And everyone needs that space to recover.
Anna Arabsky knows how deeply mental illness can affect everyone who's touched by it. She was constantly by her son's side during his years of psychosis. To come to terms with it, she wrote a letter.
Dear Psychosis, you came as an intruder, with no invite or warning, changing my life into an absurdity I couldn't comprehend. With no caution, you carried chaos and confusion, panic, fear, and disbelief into my home. Well, I had news for you, Psychosis. You'd chosen the wrong house.
Our story began October 2012 and pretty much came out of nowhere. So my son was thrust into this world of responding to things that I couldn't see here. He appeared to be, in my words, in another world, so not having much reality. And he did seem, a lot of the time, in quite a bit of distress, which, looking back, the whole experience must have been so confusing for him.
How was it affecting you at this point?
I think for me, when I was on my own in quite a small house looking after him, you live in this constant state of being hypervigilant and with lack of sleep. It was really, really difficult.
Anna Arabsky, now coordinator of Soteria House, a mental health support community in Bradford in the UK.
People who are experiencing a mental health crisis are treated as if they are isolated individuals and as if what's going on is just happening inside the chemicals in their head, and often they're responded to with hospitalisation, medication, diagnosis. And what Open Dialogue does instead is it sees a lot of these challenges are between people, even experiences like psychosis, where there are a lot of people researching to find genes and brain chemicals that they understand are involved. This approach really does see that mental health crises are between people, and so it actually invites the person and their network to all come together and talk, and that actually in that talking, things resolve. And it's not that it's anti-medication or hospitalisation or diagnosis necessarily, but they're not seen as the main way that you treat someone who's in a crisis.
Flick Gray, mental health researcher who's been awarded the 2015 Sane Australia Hocking Fellowship to investigate a model of crisis care known as Open Dialogue. This approach originated in a town called Tornio in Western Lapland in Finland around 30 years ago. At that time, psychiatric services there were poor, and Western Lapland had one of the worst incidences of schizophrenia in Europe. Now, Open Dialogue is the country's main psychiatric service model, and it's shown impressive recovery outcomes, including lower rates of hospitalisation, reduction in psychotic symptoms, and increases in family involvement. Clinical psychologist Jaakko Sukula began Open Dialogue, which he and his colleagues have been developing since the 1980s. Open Dialogue meetings bring the consumers, family, friends and health professionals together to explore new and useful perspectives on the mental health crisis.
It means first the idea that being open in a way that all the meetings in which we discuss the issues that are somewhere related either to come into hospital or community care are spoken openly, so that the clients who are need for help, they are there from the very beginning with professionals, and also that families are always invited without an idea that they need to have some problems. The second part of this dialogue means that in the meeting it's not the aim to have a rapid solution or, for instance, removing the symptoms rapidly or having change in family interaction, but it's generating dialogue to understand more what is this problem all about and what has happened in the life of the clients.
So many people who were experiencing psychosis for the first time are in a very extreme emotional state, and we're most used to it being treated with antipsychotic medication. How do you approach that extreme state in the early days?
It's very important to be there as early as possible to create a system that is available for both the population and other professionals working in other disciplines. When they meet with people, for instance, let's say a doctor or nurse in occupational health meet with a person with him, she has a strange feeling that there is something odd happening here. As early as possible to make contact to specific crisis intervention services or specific teams who are used to work in those kind of situations. And then to start a very intensive process, meeting perhaps once a day with the one who has become a patient and the family for as long time as needed. And if it happens in the process that people have a feeling that they have been taken seriously, this start to decline the anxiety and tension actually quite dramatically. You can realize that already in the very first session. And by so doing, the need for longer-term medication declines also quite much.
Often in these situations, families have been really disrupted and upset by the situation. How do you get over that possible difficulty of families making things more complicated rather than less?
They are not doing the things more complicated because they are the one whose life is in the focus. And if we manage to organize our work in a way that really makes possible to listen all the voices in the family, and this is not simple because in family, as you said, really can be very contradictory experiences of the situation within a crisis. And this is the primary challenge for therapists. How can we work in a way that the young man who, for instance, has been suspected using drugs and for that reason, having started to behave in an odd way, and his view of problem is totally different compared to mother and father. So how can we deal a kind of meeting in which the both voices, both parts of the issues are heard?
Jaakko Seukkula, developer of the Open Dialogue model for mental health crisis care. He has some unconventional hypotheses about what we call psychosis, which informs the Open Dialogue approach. He believes that any one of us could develop psychotic behaviour under very stressful life situations. The symptoms can be seen as survival strategies or reactions to inner turmoil. So is there still a place for medication?
Yeah, the optimal situation, if someone becomes for the first time in need for help, first have these very intensive meetings, and then part of the discussion we perhaps start to think what is the place of medication. But in my mind, it's a very good idea not to, as a first thing, to prescribe a long-term medication, but as a part of the process later on.
Jaakko Seukkula. Anna Arabsky's son was hospitalised for a time, then put on antipsychotic medication. After a while, the medication stopped working. A family therapist, Val Jackson, then introduced Anna to the open dialogue approach. She inspired Anna to think differently about her son's experience.
She kind of put to me that what was happening to my son was an answer to a very difficult life situation. And when you're faced with that situation, it could be possible to begin to hear voices or have unusual beliefs. And it can happen to anyone if you're put in that stressful enough situation. So the things that my son were experiencing in this other world, she described as metaphors for things that have actually happened in his life. Usually traumatic life events for which he's not found the language to express. So like open dialogue was introduced to me as something that over time a shared meaning was developed that established context for the experiences.
Anna Arabsky and her son then had some sessions with Jaakko Seukkula and Mary Olson, the lead proponents of open dialogue.
We loved how the meetings with Jaakko, Mary and Val Jackson was also there in our meetings with Jaakko and Mary. And immediately my son said it was just so great they didn't have a file in front of them. And it always feels like this file about him, which we don't get to see, he always feels that he's already been judged. And he often feels, what is the point? Because they've read the file on me, they've made their minds up already. His point was, how can you care about someone that you don't even want to get to know personally? And he commented that Jaco and Mary just weren't like that. So when we arrived at the hotel in London, there was myself, my best friend Diane, who I've known since school, so she's known my son all his life, which makes her as good as family. And there was my son and his friend Liv from the Soteria house. So I got a bit blinkered on my son's journey, and I got stuck with the idea that the only way for him to move forward now was for him to speak of his experiences. Because that way, if he speaks about the experiences, which are metaphors for painful experiences he's had in his life, then we can start to make sense of them. But for my son, me bringing this up all the time, to him, it just felt like pressure. When this was brought up in the open dialogue meeting with Jaco, it was met with a different response. So Jaco said to my son, can you or is it possible for you to speak of the experiences? And my son very clearly just said no. And I felt really disappointed because the conversation just moved on. And I thought Jaco might have explored this a bit further. But all wasn't lost, because later Mary and Jaco reflected amongst themselves while we were all listening. And she asked Jaco, so you don't think he needs to talk about his experiences? And he said, no, he decides when and he decides who, was the reply. And, you know, at that moment, I felt something and I knew something had happened then. I saw how Jaco totally accepted what my son was saying. And by accepting, it immediately took the pressure off him. And that showed me that in order to support my son, I have to accept this too. And this time I got it. So I described in the meetings how I felt that my son's constantly pulling and pushing me. Like, back off, Mum, I need to do things on my own. But the next moment, he's pulling me back in as well. So for my son, it's like, OK, I have wobbles and thanks for being there, Mum, but stop banging on about it. And I don't want to talk about it for it to be pulled apart and analysed. I'm just trying to get on with it, meaning life. So the open dialogue meeting showed me he actually is trying to get on with his life and letting his experiences, because he still has experiences, he wants them to just be a small part of his life. And I don't think I'd given him the acknowledgement or respect for doing this.
So how do you think that this open dialogue approach and these meetings has helped and perhaps improved his situation?
I met with my son a few nights later once we got back from London at the Soteria house. And firstly, I was just immediately struck by his appearance. So his usual unkempt, ruffled hair and dishevelled facial hair was now replaced with this freshly washed, tousled hair. His beard was trimmed back, but more than that, he looked truly happy. He'd been going to college, he's doing a bakery course, and he shared his produce from his class. And he talked about in the network meetings a dream that he wanted to kind of have a van and have it full of snowboards and skateboards and skis and go touring about. And from that, he's booked his first driving lesson. He said that he needed to say things and he needed to hear how it was for Diane and me. And he didn't realise that I was feeling this push and this pull. But he said to me that he thinks he needs me to be elastic for now. There were things I wanted to say and there were things I wanted to hear as well. And I think the meetings did give me a new understanding. Listening was such a big part of it. And I think lots of people with lived experience and the families, that is the one crux they all have, that they're not listened to or believed. But within open dialogue, that's not an issue at all. They do believe you and take on board everything you're saying. Open dialogue doesn't seek solutions. The solutions just happen. And they did. My son decided that the way forward for us was that he just gets on with living his life, and he needs to know that I'm getting on living my life as well.
Anna Arabsky, coordinator of Soteria House in the UK.
I made mistakes with you, learned from them, and moved on. I learned how to support my son and not rescue him. I learned not to give in to guilt and stood up to it, defying all those discourses out there that tell you to always put others before yourself. I discovered what I needed to do for my own sanity and learned to take time away from you and your world. While you continue to hold my son powerless, I could begin to give significance to his experience, and that hope for the future had returned.
You're with the All in the Mind podcast. I'm Lynn Malcolm, and we're exploring an innovative approach to managing mental health when it reaches crisis point. It's called open dialogue. Australian researcher Flick Gray has a SANE Australia Fellowship to train in the open dialogue model in the UK. She's been impressed by what she's observed in open dialogue meetings.
I've seen a family working where a young man was experiencing psychosis and he was using cannabis to self-medicate, basically, and he was staying in his room a lot, smoking a lot of pot. And his father was really concerned about him, you know, understandably. But his father was responding with really trying to control the cannabis use, like really seeing that as the problem. And the dynamic between them was actually keeping them locked in a pattern where the son was withdrawing and withdrawing. His world was shrinking and his father was trying to help. And in an open dialogue context, they're both really, really heard. And there's actually coming to understand what is the problem. And one of the things we say in open dialogue is the problem is the problem. It's like the cannabis isn't the problem, dad's not the problem, the son's not the problem. You know, it's actually trying to understand what's really going on. And it turned out, you know, that the young man had all sorts of feelings that he was unable to articulate and all sorts of experiences that he didn't have a language for. And the psychosis is actually understood as, in some sense, a language for those experiences that didn't have a verbal language, and that those experiences are interpersonal.
So how did that change, the case that you're talking about, how did the change occur from the father not understanding the son and wanting to control some aspect of his behaviour to a dialogue where the son was really being listened to?
Yeah, obviously in an hour and a half meeting, not everything changes at once. But it relies on dialogue, which is about, well, not seeking to change someone, but to actually really listen. You know, I could feel an impulse in me to want to tell dad to back off and stop being so domineering, and perhaps to tell the young man, you know, that actually the cannabis use was a problem and that needed to stop. But the therapists who are working listen to that inner polyphony, those inner voices that are going on in their head, but actually keep in dialogue, stay in dialogue. And there are moments during an open dialogue meeting where the clinicians might turn to each other and do what's called a reflection and actually talk about what's going on in their head. So the open part of open dialogue is that absolutely everything happens in front of the network. And in some ways, this models a way of being with each other. In this environment, everyone's voice, the multiple perspectives people bring, are deeply listened to. And so people can feel ambivalent in that space, and they can express their vulnerability, their frustrations, all sorts of things. And there's no sense of trying to change people, although change does happen through that deep listening. There's something really embodied about the experience. You see people, things change that are quite intangible in some ways, but they're so moving, but I think the one that stands out is a young man. He had his family and his network around him, and I've only witnessed one session with this young man, but he started to speak towards the end of the session, and I think it was partly because there was a peer worker who's in training with me who shared a little bit about her experiences with psychosis, and there was something about the way he looked at her that was this sense of, I think you get it, and he started to speak. And afterwards, his family said that they've never in their life heard him speak as much as he was now, that actually something was completely tapped into, that he started to find a language to speak. And you could see it in his face. I mean, he started the meeting and he was very shut down in a way that lots of people with, you know, quite serious experiences of distress and, you know, they can often be quite shut down. And then to see him come alive and this spark, and then to hear the excitement of his family that they were actually starting to have some conversations that they never imagined were even possible. They'd actually kind of come to a place of giving up and thinking that this young man had irrevocably changed, whereas actually there was this sense of, yeah, a flickering of life. And I think that was really, really exciting to watch.
Flick Gray. Some of the principles of open dialogue are being adopted in Australia, but as yet only in an ad hoc way. Flick Gray, through her Sane Australia Hocking Fellowship, will explore international experiences of open dialogue with a focus on its relevance to the Australian context. She'll also investigate the benefit of including friends and peers in open dialogue meetings.
What I'm interested in is looking at the different ways in which open dialogue's been applied in different contexts, and also how peer workers have been involved in that, because I think it would make very little sense to only train clinicians in Australia in open dialogue, given that the peer workforce is absolutely growing exponentially at the moment. I think there's a really exciting space there for peer workers to be involved in these network meetings as fully fledged participants. But then also the other part of the fellowship is that I'll be hosting some community dialogues around Australia, and so really engaging with some communities about what potential they see. Or at one dialogue I had, someone talked about, why am I running off to Finland to learn something that Indigenous communities here have been doing forever, you know, bringing people together to talk and assuming a relational sense of identity. And I thought that was a really interesting question, you know, about what are we already doing in Australian communities that we're just not valuing and not drawing upon as much as we could. One of the challenges has been that people say, oh, we already do that. And it's been really interesting in the training. A number of the trainees have said how profoundly they believed that when they started, that they actually thought they were already doing this. And I think when you look at open dialogue on paper, you know, there are the sort of seven principles, including, you know, immediate help and involving the family network. They're things that do look on paper like it's exactly what we're already doing. And I've certainly heard some prominent people in Australia say, oh, yes, yes, that's what we're already doing. But I think there's actually something about the philosophy about what dialogue really is. And I think it's this sense of engaging without strategically trying to change people that to me is quite a profound shift around listening. And that also one of the things it does is that it actually changes the professional culture such that people are really listening to each other. And I think it actually changes the working conditions for clinicians as well, such that they're much more able to be human and vulnerable and people in a way that I think the current system doesn't quite allow that spontaneity and just real depth of humanity.
Flick Gray. Since 1988, when open dialogue was introduced in Lapland, research and evaluation of the model has been ongoing. Jaakko Sukula.
The main part of our research has been focusing on looking at what happens for people who become psychotic for the first time. And at the 90s, we had a 5 years period in which we included all first-time psychotic patients into a follow-up. And because we were also a part of Finnish national research project, there was one idea that we were very interested. The question was, what is the place of neuroleptic medication in the treatment of psychosis? And for that reason, we followed the idea that neuroleptic medication was not started in the beginning, and only if there is a need to go into the medication. And first surprise was that one-third of the patients used this neuroleptic medication, and 2/3 never used it during the 5 years period of time that we followed their life. And in the follow-up, we also realized that the outcome were quite optimal in many respects, because 81% of those people who came psychotic for the first time had returned to full employment, and 81% did not have any remaining psychotic symptoms. This is quite extraordinary, and this has in a way verified that this open dialogue treatment that mobilized the resources of the families very fast after the crisis has emerged can be very helpful to have the people remain in an active social life. That's the main outcome that we have reached. And we repeated the same study 10 years after and actually realized that the outcomes were about the same. And very interestingly, what had happened was that the duration of untreated period had become shorter and shorter, which tells us that the population has learned to take very active contact immediately after crisis emerged. And of course, it's much better for the survival and recovery.
So from your experience here in Australia and talking to people in the mental health area, what do you think it would take for Australians to move more towards this sort of approach?
First of all, I've seen a big interest of this kind of work in Australia that is very encouraging for me in many respects, that we as a professional start to have a discussion of our clients in a way that is not only focusing on looking at the symptoms and defining how severe pathologized these persons are and plan of the steps of the treatment, but try to understand of life, how their problems are connected to life. And this would be a big change in attitude.
Jaakko Sukula.
If you ever feel the need to come into our home again, I will not stand fast in your way. I will welcome you and believe in you. I will advocate your presence. And with my son, together, we will normalize the significance you bring and the emotions you need my son to address. You taught me how to live life for the here and now, instead of planning too far into the future. I'm now living my life as I intended to. I know what has happened today, but nobody knows what tomorrow will bring. I can only be prepared. Thank you, your friend and believer, Anna.
From the letter that Anna Arabsky wrote to her son's psychosis.
I've always been incredibly proud of my son from the first day of his psychosis, how he got up and faced every day with whatever voice, belief or persecution he had to go through. I was proud of him then, and I'm proud of him now that he's finding a way to live his life, even though he may still feel those experiences are there. So immense pride, and a lot of pride for myself as well. I just feel so proud that I never gave up on him.
Anna Arabsky is coordinator of Soteria House in the UK, and she joined me via Skype. Thanks to Kerry Stewart for reading Anna's letter to psychosis. Head to the All in the Mind website for details from today, and we'd love to hear from you, so leave a comment on the site while you're there. Production today by Diane Dean and Mark Don. I'm Lynn Malcolm. Catch you next time. Bye for now.